Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Jim Wilson talks about sandcastles and sand martens.
There are fleas that hang out on sand martens during the summer. They live in a cocoon over winter in the nest at the back of the burrow. And when the sand martens arrive, first they go in and they look around the nest, and that little bit of movement triggers the fleas to come out of their cocoon. They then become attracted to the light and they move out the burrow to the entrance. And then when the sand martens are flying into the burrow, the sudden change in light, in other words, when the shadow of the bird comes across the flea, they automatically jump onto the sand martin.
A Mooney listener from Bray poses an interesting question about devoted dads in the animal kingdom.
I was watching a YouTube video about emus and I just have a quick question. Why do male emus incubate the eggs and raise the young as opposed to the female?
And we ask you to join our army of citizen scientists in aid of the cuckoo.
Fáilte do nÉin is binne ar críobh. The words of the poet Seamus Dáil MacCuirte, written over 300 years ago. And of course what it means is, welcome to the sweetest bird on the branch. Who else but the cuckoo?
As always, a very busy programme ahead of us today. If you're a regular listener to RTE Radio, you may well have heard this promo being broadcast over the weekend. Mooney Goes Wild needs you.
The interesting thing about the cuckoo's song, Derek, is that the cook part of the song is made with the mouth open, while the oo part of it is made with the mouth closed.
To join our army of citizen scientists, tune into Mooney Goes Wild, Mondays from 10 p.m. on RTE Radio 1. The cuckoo is one of Ireland's most iconic migratory bird species, famous both for the classic cuckoo song of the male and the female's obligate brood parasitism, meaning that she always lays her eggs in the nests of other birds. The species has declined significantly across much of Ireland, however, and finds itself in trouble, which is why today we're mobilising the Mooney Goes Wild Citizen Science Army to shout out for the cuckoo. We want you to let us know where and when you hear or see your first cuckoo of the year. We will share your records with the coordinators of Birdwatch Ireland's Spring Alive project, and the data will help them to conserve the Irish breeding populations of this vulnerable species. So when you are out and about, and if you're lucky enough to hear or see one, please shout out by emailing details of where and when you heard or saw it to mooney@rte.ie. Now, we're going to talk a lot about cuckoos on the programme today with our panel. Let's start with Aina Nealana. Aina, are you still in County Clare?
I am indeed, Derek. I'm in County Clare, a most wonderful place, and a place where there are loads of cuckoos. Anytime I ever hear the cuckoo nowadays, in the last few years, it's been in County Clare. Now, mind you, this is very early in April, so I haven't heard them as yet, because you know the old saying that says, if a cuckoo sings on a bare thorn, sell your cow and buy some corn. And the hawthorns are only just beginning to get their leaves. So I don't expect to hear a cuckoo for another week or so, because the thorns are still slightly bare down here, and I wouldn't want to be selling me cow and buying corn. Thank you very much.
Richard, any out in Malahide? Or did you ever have them in Malahide?
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm here 50 years now, and when I came first, there were cuckoos. They were relatively common. You could see them in the sand dunes in Malahide Island, but there haven't been one there in 25 years that I've heard. And I'm sure my hearing is still good. Of course, the cuckoo doesn't build a nest, Anna reminds me, because he's too busy with all the predictions he has to fulfil, you know, the pishogues. He's so busy, he hasn't time to build a nest, and that's why he... or she lays her egg in another bird's nest.
Now let's go to Niall Hatch, who's normally in Greystones, but not there today, I believe, Niall.
No, I'm in Shankill in South County Dublin, almost just on the Dublin-Wicklow border. I'm just beside Shankill Dart Station at a place called Shangana Cliffs. I have Bray Head down to the south of me. I have Killiney Hill and Docky Island to the north of me. And I should stress that I'm here with permission. I'm actually looking at a colony of a migrant bird called the sand marten. They nest in the cliff face here. They've just arrived, one of our first migrants in. And so I'm here to monitor those today and to talk to all of you lovely people as well.
Well, we'll be talking to Jim Wilson in Cove a little bit later on in the programme, and we'll be talking about sand martens and building giant sand castles for sand martens. But now, the status of the cuckoo in Ireland, please.
Well, the cuckoo is a bird that, although it still occurs in all 32 counties, it has declined very markedly over the last 20 years in particular. Things like agricultural intensification, climate change, all of these things are having a big effect on it. So it's a species that we are worried about. It's nowhere near as common as it used to be. And indeed, a generation or two ago, we wouldn't have had to describe the sound of a cuckoo or explain it to people. Everyone would have been familiar with it. Not so today. There'd be a lot of people listening to us who've never actually heard a cuckoo in the flesh or in the feather, which is really upsetting, really. It's really tragic. The cuckoo, of course, it's many things that are conspiring against it. It's a long-distance migrant across the Sahara, of course, each year, so it goes back and forth between Europe and Africa. And climate change makes that journey a little bit more difficult every year, along with problems with desertification in Africa as well. The Sahara Desert is getting wider by the year, which has an effect on these birds because they have to cross that. It's inhospitable terrain. And the wider the desert gets, the fewer of these migrants, like the cuckoos and the swallows, indeed, and the swifts, are going to make it. So that's a problem for them. Of course, cuckoos famously lay their eggs in the nests of other birds, so they need to have host species to parasitize. They're brood parasites, as we call it. And that means that they rely especially on birds like meadow pipits, also birds like sedge warblers, even dunnocks. The different female cuckoos will use different bird species. And the populations of those birds have declined as well. So the fewer of those there are, the fewer nesting opportunities or rearing opportunities there are for these cuckoos. That's hitting them badly. And then to add insult to injury, their food supply is disappearing as well. Cuckoos specialise in feeding on those hairy moth caterpillars, especially the really big ones. Most birds and other creatures won't eat them because those hairs cause a lot of irritation in their throats and on the skin of humans if we were fool enough to touch them as well. But the cuckoos are immune to that. They can eat them quite easily. But of course, as we have problems with pollution and pesticides and climate change and agricultural intensification, there are fewer of these moth caterpillars around, which means less food for the cuckoos. So it's very important we keep track of these birds and do what we can to save the population we have left.
Niall, I was going to say that you're saying a lot of the problems with the reduction in cuckoos in Ireland is because of the troubles that they have coming here. Now, they come to us every summer back from Africa, and looking at research that the BTO were doing with trackers, there are two routes that the cuckoos from Africa take going back to these parts. Now, the cuckoos they ringed were actually from the southeast of England, and these cuckoos have two routes. Some of them go straight up through Italy and up that way up to Britain, and the other ones in the same group go along the west coast of Africa up through Spain and into Britain that way. And that western group seems to be having more difficulty. Do we have any knowledge of the route that our cuckoos take, given that we haven't perhaps put any tags like that on cuckoos from Ireland? Do our ones entirely use the western route, or do they use a different route entirely, or is there any way of knowing as yet?
Well, Aina, there is no way to know as yet. I think that logic would suggest that it probably is that western population, like the ones you find in western Britain, but the Irish birds haven't been tagged, so that's just speculation at the moment. The BTO, the British Trust for Ornithology, have obviously put these trackers on some birds returning to Britain, but it hasn't happened in Ireland yet. But given the declines we've had in the cuckoo as a species in Ireland, it would suggest it probably is that population that's been the worst hit. And it would make sense, of course, from a migratory route point of view, that the birds in the westernmost part of Africa would come up to Ireland, and maybe more eastern birds are going up into Britain. I know another population goes up to Scandinavia as well, but we still have a lot to find out. A lot of what I'm saying is just speculation at the moment.
Yes, indeed. I mean, they've had cuckoos ever since anyone can remember. I mean, even the poets were inspired to write poems about cuckoos in both Irish and in English. It's a famous poem, of course, by Wordsworth. "O blithe newcomer, I have heard, I hear thee and rejoice. O cuckoo, shall I call thee bird or but a wandering voice?" So was Wordsworth really some sort of a bird expert in his spare time? Or was it just that it's just so easy to identify the cuckoo that even somebody with his head in the clouds looking at daffodils or what have you could be impacted upon by a cuckoo. So is there anything else it could be mistaken for if we're asking people to send us in records? Niall, will there be other things that the cuckoo can be mixed up with? Just to note, is it easy for someone to fake a cuckoo call, for example? Can we actually rely on records coming in by sounds that people in good faith send us in thinking that they're cuckoos?
Well, I know there are certainly mistakes every year, absolutely, because a lot of people have not heard the cuckoo before in real life. So in Wordsworth's time, everybody would have been familiar with that sound. It would have been a very typical sound of the countryside. People wouldn't have even thought of it as being unusual. Here in Ireland, we do have birds like the wood pigeon and the collared dove. They often sing quite early in the year. You'll get them even in January or February singing. And every year in the national newspapers, you'll have people writing in saying, I just heard a cuckoo on the 1st of February. Is this a record? I always want to write back and say no, but it is a mistake, because it would be impossible for a cuckoo to be in Ireland and singing at that stage of the year. What it is a collared dove or a wood pigeon. They make cooing noises, but it's nowhere near as distinct and emphatic as that of the cuckoo. My general rule of thumb is, if you have to ask yourself if it was a cuckoo you heard or not, then it wasn't a cuckoo, because when you hear the real thing, there is no mistaking it. That really sharp, penetrating two notes, hard for people to imitate as well, with the same sort of force that a cuckoo would have. Even an owl with the hooting noises that they make, and in Ireland we don't have the tawny owl that does the famous tuit tuwoo call. We do have long-eared owls which do make a hooting noise, but it's nothing like that cuckoo, cuckoo that the cuckoos make. Once you hear the real thing, there is no mistaking it. So when people hear that, they can be sure they've heard a cuckoo for real.
Actually, Niall, I noticed on your website that when you put the written description of the sound of a cuckoo, it's wookoo with a W, wookoo.
Yes, and different cultures describe it in different ways, because of course these birds don't use vowels and consonants the way that we do. It's more of a, it is more of a wookoo. Woo, woo, like that. Really, really beautiful sound. But a bit annoying if you're hearing it all day long, I suppose, as people would have heard in the past. It would have been quite an irritating sound. Cuckoos all over the world of many different species, they have these sort of very mechanical sounds that just seem like sounding machines going on and on. There's a cuckoo in parts of Asia called the Asian Coel, which people call the brain fever bird, because its sound just keeps going. I know we've had it on the Dawn Chorus program from India. When they've been in, we've had that sound, and it sounds like the bird has gone insane. People used to think that of the cuckoo too, that it, you know, because unlike other birds that have these rich melodic songs, it just says the same notes over and over. A sound, unfortunately, we don't hear so much in the Irish countryside, which is why in Birdwatch Ireland we're so keen to track them through projects like Spring Alive and our Countryside Bird Survey.
Well, we'll talk about Spring Alive in just a moment, but why not at this point? Let's stop and pause, because Aine has brought up a very relevant point there. So have a listen to this sound, boys and girls at home, and Richard, Aine and Niall, do you know what this bird is?
Well, I do know that one, Derek. That's the wood pigeon. It's not a cuckoo.
And our next sound now, Richard, for you.
Well, now you couldn't be mistaken about that. That is the cuckoo. And the interesting thing about that call is that the first syllable is made with the mouth open. That's the cook part, and the other part of the sound, the oo, is made with the mouth closed. Now, I think, Anna, you mentioned that Wordsworth, you wondered if he was an ornithologist. Well, that poem tells you that he was, because the poem says, O cuckoo, shall I call thee bird or but a wandering voice? Now, the interesting thing about cuckoos in Ireland is that you hear them, but you don't see them. They are quite hard to see. And of course, Wordsworth is echoing that it's a wandering voice. It's hard to find him. You hear him a long way off, but it's hard to find him. The female cuckoo is bubbling. The female cuckoo is hiding all the time. She doesn't come forth at all. She has to be very like that, because she is watching out for birds to parasitize. And if she were to display herself or make herself prominent, then, of course, she would alert the host species that she's around. So she doesn't do that. Niall mentioned earlier the reasons for decline. And now, I used to think that the reasons for the decline of the cuckoo in Ireland were that Bonnetru na Cuaica, the cuckoo's nurse, was declining, and it is. The surveys show that the medipipit has declined, and I thought that the reason that the cuckoo had declined was that there were fewer medipipits for it to parasitise. I remember putting that to Nick Davis when you and I met him, Derek, that very memorable day we spent with him on Wicken Fen, and I put that idea to him, and he dismissed it. Why? He said that his reed warblers over there had increased in number over the years, whereas the cuckoo had declined. He had 14 individual cuckoos singing in 1985, and that by 2013 he only had two. So he said it's not the decline of reed warblers, because they are as abundant as ever. In fact, they're slightly more abundant. It isn't a shortage of host species. So I asked, well, what is it then? Well, one possibility he suggested was a decline in caterpillar numbers. The decline in insects generally was certainly a worry, because the cuckoo likes to eat those caterpillars that nothing else can feed to their young, the hairy mollies that produce poisons. The poisons upset the tummies of chicks, so the birds tend to go off them during the nesting season. But the cuckoo can cash in on this surplus. All these hairy mollies that the other birds aren't eating are available to them. And Nick thought, well, their numbers have gone down, and that might explain it. But he was very agnostic about this. He wasn't dogmatic at all about the matter.
For the benefit of those of you who are listening for the first time or didn't catch up with the interview Richard is referring to there with Nick Davies. Nick Davies is a zoologist and professor of behavioural ecology at the University of Cambridge. He's also the author of the acclaimed book Cuckoo, Cheating by Nature. A great read if you have any interest in cuckoos. But we met him at Wicken Fen in Cambridgeshire. Now, Wicken Fen is the National Trust's oldest fen, and one of the most important biological sites for studying cuckoos in all of Europe, which is where Nick Davies did all of his work. And when we were there, he showed us a nest of a reed warbler. In Ireland, the host species is a meadow pipit, but there it's the reed warbler. And it was extraordinary to see this huge bird in this tiny nest.
So sometimes when the light's very bright, it's sometimes difficult to see.
Look at that.
Oh, wow.
Wow, look at that.
That is just beautiful, Nick.
So,
absolutely.
So what we have here is a little reed warbler nest. It's not much bigger than a tennis ball. And it's a beautiful cup, a little basket, suspended between three reed stems. It's about a metre above the water surface. And inside this, practically filling the cup, we have a cuckoo chick.
My God.
Isn't it amazing?
Isn't he huge? He's going to burst out of it very soon. And he's by no means much grown, is he?
No, he's about 8 days old, and he's still got another week at least in the nest. Now, if I just nudge the reeds a little with this stick, look, he's opening his orange gape, a blaze of orange, and he's already got a little defensive display where he rears up and jerks at you. And this must be a very effective deterrent against predators. He looks quite reptilian because his feathers are still in quill. And in a week's time, he'll completely overflow the nest, and the nest gets flattened into a little platform, so you just see cuckoo.
Oh my God. That is an absolutely beautiful sight.
And if you'll notice, there's a big willow tree just behind us, and I suspect she just sat very quietly there, watching the reed warblers build their nest, and was able to time the laying of her egg, just get it right.
And the little reed warblers are probably watching us now, waiting
they
to
are.
Come back and waste all their energy raising this chick of their enemy. Isn't it dreadful?
It's amazing. These reed warblers have come all the way from Africa to breed on Wicken Fen, and they've spent the whole summer raising a chick of the wrong species, and they'll go back to Africa having made no genetic profit whatsoever.
Isn't nature cruel?
Cruel indeed. It was an extraordinary sight. That was the first time I had ever seen a cuckoo chick in the nest of a host species. In fact, I haven't seen one since. And as I mentioned, in Wicken Fen, it's the reed warbler, but here in Ireland, it's the meadow pipit. Sorry, Aine, I interrupted you because you're about to continue the conversation about hairy mollies, which Richard mentioned before I played that clip.
you know, if the cuckoo sings on a bare thorn, it might be nothing to do with selling your corn or selling your cow and getting corn. If the cuckoo sings on a bare thorn, then there are no leaves for the caterpillars to actually feed on and become hairy mollies. So is there, I wonder, a disconnect between climate change and the leaves coming on the trees and on the arrival of the cuckoo? Are they coming at the right time, or is there one situation not in harmony or in keeping with the other, so that the hairy mollies aren't here in time? Maybe the hairy mollies have been and gone and turned back into butterflies, or what? Could you give me the benefit of your wonderful mind as you consider that situation, Richard?
Can I have that in writing, Ian, and my wonderful mind thing, you know? Anyway, look, I'll tell you a few interesting things there. First of all, climate change is making things come earlier. Now, I understand from British papers and things that the migrant birds are coming in about 15 days earlier than they did, say, at the beginning of the last century or the middle of the last century. Whereas the cuckoos are only coming 4 or 5 days earlier than they did long ago. So there is a discrepancy between the arrival of the two groups. However, there's another factor in this, and that is that the male cuckoo arrives before the female cuckoo. He's the one that chooses the likely places where females might nest. So he's reconnaissance. He's doing the reconnaissance. He's coming in and deciding, this would be a good place, I'll start singing here. So the ladies come along somewhat later, maybe 2 weeks or so after the male. So he's already set up. So the cuckoo sound is already there before the females are going to nest at all. So your caterpillars have plenty of time to come out and develop for them to feed. Now, the whole thing, of course, I think the cuckoo should be the patron saint of insurance companies, because what this is all about is insurance. You're going to lay your eggs in various nests. Up to 25 have been recorded, but the normal number is around 8 or 9. Now, what you're seeing here is not putting one's eggs all in one basket. If you put all your eggs in one nest and the cat gets it, or a fox or something, you lose everything. But if you spread them over 8 or 9 or 20 other nests, then some of them will go down, but you'll have something to show for it no matter what happens. So it's an interesting strategy.
Niall, the BTO survey with trackers on the cuckoos, I presume there's still some cuckoos returning. Have those cuckoos that they tagged come back to Britain yet? Are the returns to Britain the same time as the returns to Ireland, or do we know where these cuckoos are? Are they en route? Are they here? Or did they survive the winter? Is there any story even on the British tagged cuckoos, do you think?
I believe they haven't returned yet. They are en route, and these trackers that the British Trust for Ornithology have put on cuckoos have been really, really interesting, because it shows that some of them are very faithful to the same wintering spots in West Africa and in Central Africa each year, whereas other individuals wander much more widely. They seem to go all over the place in search of food, and it's also showing not just the wintering areas that are important for them, but it's showing the migratory routes that they take. As expected, a lot of them in Western Europe tend to go down through Iberia, across the Straits of Gibraltar and into Morocco. You also get other ones coming up through Italy, and it seems that some of those birds now are en route. They have gone through Italy and are heading up through Central Europe at the moment. I'd say they'd make landfall in Britain very soon. It really kind of depends on the weather. When there's locally heavy rain or heavy winds, that'll hold them back for a few days. But their arrival is imminent, almost like clockwork, which is ironic, I suppose, given that they're associated with clocks themselves. The cuckoos will be back. So looking forward to that very much. And it's really interesting to see the results of these tracking surveys. The trackers that the British Trust for Ornithology put on these cuckoos are very expensive, which is why so few of them have actually been used so far. But as the technology gets better and gets smaller and gets cheaper, I'm sure we'll be doing a lot more tracking of these birds. And hopefully some Irish cuckoos can be tracked in due course as well.
Speaking of clocks, I have to tell you a very sad story. Last year, whenever I was in schools last, I was talking about cuckoos and telling the kids about this bird. And there were a couple of boys in a school in Dublin who could not be assured, fell around the seats laughing, that I thought a cuckoo was a bird, when they knew for a fact that it was part of a clock. And no matter how much I told them there was a real thing called the cuckoo bird, they thought this mad woman coming in thinks the thing that lives in a clock is a bird. Isn't that terrible? Oh, I was appalled, I have to say.
It's my favourite scene from The Sound of Music.
But I was shocked.
But you know the scene I'm talking about, when they're singing so long, farewell, Alvida Zane and Jew.
Oh, I do indeed, when they're not allowed to go to the ball and they all have to go to bed instead. And they even sing, the cuckoo comes out and they sing, cuckoo, cuckoo. Yeah. I know the one indeed, Derek.
Would you like to hear it, Aina? Just a little bit of it.
Oh, you can't get it at such speed, can you?
Oh, this is magic. This programme is Mooney's Magic, not Mooney Goes Wild.
There's a sad sort of clanging from the clock in the hall and the bells in the steeple too. And up in the nursery an absurd little bird is popping out to say cuckoo.
Cuckoo. Cuckoo.
Regretfully cuckoo. They tell us, but firmly cuckoo. They compel us to say goodbye cuckoo. To you.
There you go, just for you, Ada, and the listeners. Anyway, continue.
No, but not to think that such a thing existed, to think it was only a made-up thing. I mean, that's the last straw altogether, really and truly. Absolutely. We're not doing our job if people think there is no such thing as a cuckoo, but just something that's in a clock, in the Sound of Music, or made in Switzerland or something, that it isn't the real McCoy. So with this campaign, Derek, that we're doing to get people out to listen, people are out anyway walking about and they can't go very far, so more reasons to take the earphones out of your ears and go out and listen. They have to be more cuckoos than just a few in the west of Ireland. There must have been Wicklow, there are lots of places. We must surely encourage the kids to go out and listen for real cuckoos, not things that only live in clocks.
And that's exactly what we're going to do here. We're going to ask each and every one of our listeners to become a citizen scientist. Join the Mooney Army and record those cuckoos. We're going to pass that information on to Birdwatch Ireland, which will feed into their Spring Alive campaign. Niall.
Yes, Spring Alive is a really wonderful project that's been going for about 15 years now. It's been a real success. We don't just do it here in Ireland. It's something that's coordinated across the BirdLife International Partnership in over 40 countries. So a lot of people right now across Europe and Central Asia are recording these migrant birds as they arrive back in. It's several common species we're looking for. So it's swift, swallow, cuckoo, of course, sand martin, a bird called the ringed plover, a common bird on beaches here in Ireland. I can actually see one here on Shangana Beach at Shankill at the moment. And also on continental Europe, you also have two other birds, the white stork and the beater, which are only very rare vagrants to us here in Ireland. And then again, in the autumn time, those birds are heading down to Africa, and people in Africa start recording them all the way from Morocco right down to South Africa. And the data we get from this tells us a huge amount about the average arrival dates of these birds as they pass through each location. The website is springalive.net for anyone who wants to check it out. You can learn about migratory birds there. You can report your sightings. And of course, if Mooney Goes Wild listeners could please report their cuckoos to the programme, that would be very much appreciated, because this data feeds into an international database all across the BirdLife International Partnership to protect these birds. It tells us a great deal, and everyone can be a scientist. There are lots of budding amateur ornithologists out there who can really help us with this information, and lots of fun games and activities on the website there as well. So it really is a very worthwhile project and a wonderful piece of citizen science. And we're very proud in Ireland that despite the fact there are 40 other countries taking part, every year Ireland records the highest per capita number of records in the whole world for Spring Alive. So we're looking to do bigger and better again this year.
Aina, I'm sure there's been many Irish poets who've referred to the cuckoo in their poems.
Well, there has indeed, but the one that everybody knows is the one that goes, Fáilte don Éin is Bine Ar Craobh. And these are the words of the poet Seamus Dáil MacCuarta, which were written over 300 years ago. Welcome to the sweetest bird on the branch. Who else but the harbinger of summer?
The cuckoo.
Indeed, the cuckoo.
So, you know what you got to do. Send details of the recordings of your first cuckoo heard or seen, so it could be a picture, either to mooney@rte.ie. More about that next week. Now, let's move on. We received an audio message from a listener in Bray. Her name is Michaela, and she has a question, very interesting question, about devoted dads in the animal kingdom. Have a listen.
Hi, Derek. I was watching a YouTube video about emus, and I just have a quick question. Why do male emus incubate the eggs and raise the young as opposed to the female? Is this common among other birds, or is there a reason why emus are special?
So, she's wondering why male emu dads take care of the eggs and the young, and is it common amongst birds and indeed other animals, I suppose?
Well, good question, considering it's Easter time and egg time, and if Dad didn't take care of the eggs, nobody would, because the female emu is some bird, I'm telling you. She visits the male in his nest, she mates with him, she lays the eggs, green eggs, big thick ones, and then off she skedaddles, and she may even mate with another male sitting on a nest too, but she doesn't come back to sit on any of the eggs. And poor old daddy has to sit on these eggs for maybe up to 50 days, and he can't feed, and he can't drink, and he can't do poos, any of those sort of things. He has to wait there till they hatch out, and then he has to mind them then until they get big enough to fend for themselves. It's some turn up for the books there, isn't it, Richard?
Well, yes, it's a maximising of resources. After all, she's produced these eggs. That takes a lot of resources, and she's put all her efforts into those. Now the eggs are laid, so he's the one with the resources, and he can afford to spend the next 7 weeks warming those eggs to incubate them. So now we're using up his reserves in the interests of the babies. It's a very interesting way to do things. The big flightless birds don't really want to be birds, remember. They want to be cattle or deer. They're going back to the way cattle, and they're flightless now, so they're behaving more like their dinosaur ancestors did, or more like cattle and sheep and deer do. So it's an and they have a similar kind of approach. The bull does all his gathering the females together, and then the female lays, and then the bull protects the herd afterwards. So it's going back to his roots in a sense.
Yeah, well, they don't all do it. I know the rhea in South America does. In fact, the female rhea can go off and mate with 3 or 4 or 5 different males and have her eggs in lots of different nests. And the males there have to rear the young as well. And I can understand it's the same story as the emu. But then the ostrich doesn't do it, and it's a flightless bird too. So they don't all necessarily do it. Some do, some don't.
Well, they all go for polygamy, the same as cattle, sheep and deer, say, are polygamous in the way they behave. Now, these flightless birds are behaving the same way. And what's happening with the ostrich, of course, is that he creates a nest. The female lays a few eggs in the nest, and then other females come along. He mates with them, and they lay an egg or two in his nest. And the vast number of eggs build up in the nest, up to 70 at times, have been recorded. And then he sits by day, she sits by night. No, it's the other way around. He sits by night and she sits by day to incubate. But again, they're sharing the resources. They're distributing everything they've got in the interests of the babies. Now, the rheas in South America, they have a rather peculiar system. In fact, the male starts to incubate the eggs, but he's likely to recruit a helper, a young male, and get the young male to take over. And then he goes off and he starts a second nest, a second clutch. People ask, what's in it for the young male? Well, it's suggested that the young male is an apprentice. He's learning how to be a daddy, how to incubate, how to go through the process of mating and so forth. And it is suggested that on the QT, he has the odd mating with the female, and in that way his genes get promulgated. But all these big flightless birds are odd. They're all going back to the ways of the ungulates that they so much resemble, and the ways the dinosaurs, the two-legged dinosaurs, had a way back before they evolved into birds.
But when it comes to the animal kingdom, is it just the birds where the males step in and take over the maternal duties, let's say?
No, seahorses do it as well. In fact, the seahorses, your woman has a great trick here. The female just deposits her eggs in the seahorse's pouch, and then he has to fertilise them himself in his own pouch. He has to carry them until they grow to be little baby seahorses, and then he has to give birth to them. So it means the female seahorse really has it sewn up. She just dumps her eggs in his pouch, and off she goes. There you are. So that one certainly is very well known to be a case where the male has to do all of the work.
The system is a bit unfair to females, the breeding system, because she has to do all the work of creating the youngster and delivering it. So systems which try to exploit the male's provenance, these are slow to evolve, but they have evolved. Males spend a lot more time selecting the right females, or rather she spends more time making them the best possible male she can select. But it's an unbalanced system in a way.
Listen, I don't know if you guys found yesterday, but I couldn't get an egg. There wasn't an egg to be had anywhere. What is the biggest egg in the world? Does anybody know?
Derek, now, there's the trouble with that question is that there's contradictory answers. One is says that the largest egg in the world is the ostrich's egg, but the smallest egg in the world is also the ostrich's egg. The ostrich lays a very big egg, but in proportion to its body size, it's only something like 2% of the adult's weight. Now, if you look at something like the kiwi, which is a small little flightless bird of New Zealand, it lays an egg that's 20% of its weight. And the kiwi's egg is the largest in proportion to its size of any egg. The ostrich is the smallest in proportion to its size of any egg.
Well, Aina and Richard, thank you very much indeed. We'll talk to you again next week. Niall is still there in Shankill. And right now, I want to say hello to Jim Wilson, who's at his home in Cove in County Cork. Jim will be joining the presentation team for this year's Dawn Chorus, which takes place on the 2nd of May, the first weekend in May, the peak time to hear the birds singing. Jim, how's everything in Cove? How are you today?
Derek, I'm great. Absolutely great. Great to talk to you. Really looking forward to doing the Dawn Chorus back in Kilskinny Marsh Nature Reserve on the 2nd of May. As we know, the birds will sing regardless. And they're even singing now. Anybody that's been out doing their exercise walk and that around their locality is bound to be hearing some of the members of the chorus that will be in full song come the 2nd of May.
Indeed. Now, let's say hello again to Niall Hatch, who's in Shankill. Niall mentioned earlier that he is on the beach there because he's monitoring some sand martens. Correct, Niall?
Yes, Derek, I'm in Shankill. I'm actually very close to Shankill Dart Station at a place called Shangana Cliffs, which is a wonderful place for nesting sand martens. I'm here to monitor their colony just to see if any of the early arrivals are showing an interest in nesting there. And it's a really lovely spot. I'm also very much looking forward, though, to getting down to Cove. It'd be nice to go a bit further afield. The Dawn Chorus is one of the absolute highlights of my year. I absolutely love it. And at Kilskinny Marsh, we'd never have a bad Dawn Chorus. It's always really good. The birds are singing, something really life-affirming and inspiring about that. And I think, you know, since COVID first hit over a year ago now, more and more people have becoming, you know, really accustomed to birdsong, taking a lot of comfort and solace from it. It's really added a lot to people's lives. So I'm thinking we're going to have a lot of new people tuning in this year. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, guys, I want you to have a listen to this sound and tell me if you think you know what it is.
Wow, I wasn't expecting that, Derek. It definitely sounds like a big machine. Possibly maybe a JCB or a bulldozer. Maybe, I don't know what make, but definitely something like a bulldozer.
Absolutely spot on, Jim. And what is it doing? Well, it's constructing a giant sandcastle for sand martens in Surrey. Now, Jim, you showed me my very first sand marten bank. I can't even remember how many years ago, but it was in Cork.
That's correct, Derek. East Cork in particular, because of the last ice age, believe it or not, we are blessed with an abundance of sand and gravel under the ground here. And of course, we extract a lot of it for building and for all sorts of reasons. And what it creates are these cliffs of sand. And sand martens, the hint is in their name, like to burrow into the sandy cliffs to make their nests. They would have originally been using riverbanks. And in fact, in America, the sand martin is called the bank swallow. And of course, in recent times, a lot of the waterways have been altered and changed. Not so many sandbanks at the edge of rivers. And they've taken to using sand pits. And of course, conservation work then comes into this because we realise that if we can create the habitat for them, usually they will come and use it.
Now, this is an extraordinary adventure, and I have some experience of building nesting sites for birds. A long time ago, I was involved with constructing a kingfisher bank down at Druids Glen on the golf course there. But this is on another scale altogether. So it's big. You've seen the pictures in The Guardian and in other newspapers, I assume, have you?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the deluxe model. You know, normally when you see designs for creating a sand martin breeding bank, they're usually very small, maybe 8, 10, 15 feet long. But this thing looks, it's huge. It's absolutely on an enormous scale. And I think they have a better chance. They've done their homework already. They know the birds have been in the area and they're trying to entice them in. And of course, the beauty about creating a bank that size is if the birds do take, they're within an area that will be protected, that is not in danger of being destroyed for whatever reason. And that's the beauty of it. You're trying to move the birds to somewhere where they have a much better chance of surviving into the future.
Niall, now you're in Shankill in Shangana, and you're actually in a place where sand martins nest in the breeding season.
That's right, Derek. I'm actually looking right at their nesting holes now in these soft cliffs just here on the edge of the Irish Sea near to Shankill Dart Station. Every year the sand martins come back here. It's a natural nest site for them, and they actually excavate those nesting tunnels themselves. They dig them out with their feet and they use their bills as well, but they shovel all the dirt and detritus out from the holes and make these tunnels. Now, they consistently come back, but this cliffs here are very soft, so they're actually very prone to erosion from the wind and from the sea. So every year there's little places where the cliffs have collapsed slightly. It's not maybe the most secure site, but the birds do seem to like it, and there are several dozen pairs that nest here. As I'm talking to you, there are actually a couple of sand martins just arrived from Africa flying around me. They're going over the nesting colony, not going into the holes yet. It might be a bit early in the season for that just yet, but I'm sure that the nesting activity will start very soon, because the sand martin is one of the first spring migrants to come back to us in Ireland. I always associate them really with St. Patrick's Day. From St. Patrick's Day onwards, they start to come into Ireland, and as Jim said, they're a member of the swallow family. Lovely brown sort of sandy bird above that helps to camouflage them in this sort of sandy habitat. White below with this brown band across their chests, and they have a short little forked tail, nowhere near as elaborate as the big forked tail with the streamers of the swallow, but a very similar flight action. They are closely related. They have those pointed wings of the swallows. They're long distance migrants, but unlike the swallows, which would often go and nest in barns and sheds and always inside human structures, these sand martins have a completely different nesting habitat, and it's really nice to be here and see the start of their breeding season to see them returning.
Have you noticed any in Cork yet, Jim?
Ah, yeah, Derek. We're on the south coast, so we tend to get the migrants coming up from Africa and southern Europe first along the south coast. Not always. East coast can get them sometimes, but they're definitely in. They've been seen. We're getting quite a few records now on our Facebook page and to our email address. And it's always a fantastic time of year. People are starting getting excited. They know that the summer is coming. As Niall alluded to already, with the year we've had, you know, with COVID and everything, it creates great hope. It shows that life goes on. Things can change, and they are changing now. And we've actually done a little bit of work here in relation to creating habitat for sand martins just recently. Our Tidy Towns committee, Henrik Vervey and the committee there who do great work, got on to us and said, any biodiversity projects we could do? And we said, we'll think about it. And Alan Farrell, who's on the local Birdwatch Ireland branch, he saw an old disused gravel pit and sand pit here on Great Island where Cove is, and he approached the owner, Mr. Coffey, who was only delighted to have it redone. The cliff face opened up, clearing away bits around the edge, and they've created a beautiful piece of sand martin habitat, and we're just keeping our fingers crossed now that they will spot it and start breeding there.
Have you ever actually seen inside of a sand martin nest? When we see the front of the bank, yeah, you just see all these holes in it, in the sand. Mm. But what's going on inside those little tunnels, if I can call them tunnels?
Yeah, tunnel is a good word for it. And you mentioned the kingfisher. They do a similar thing. The tunnel can be up to a metre, if not more sometimes, depending on the type of sand and everything else. And so they build a long tunnel, and at the back then they have the nesting chamber. And they line the nest a bit there. It's not a very elaborate nest, but it's nice and cosy. And very interestingly, there are fleas that hang out on sand martins during the summer. This is really interesting. They live in a cocoon over winter in the nest at the back of the burrow. And when the sand martins arrive first, they go in and they look around the nest, and that little bit of movement triggers the fleas to come out of their cocoon, and believe it or not, they then become attracted to the light and they move out the burrow to the entrance. And then when the sand martins are flying into the burrow, apparently the sudden change in light, in other words, when the shadow of the bird comes across the flea, they automatically jump, and they jump onto the sand martin. Spend the summer on the sand martin, flying around with it and everything, and in the winter, back to the back of the burrow and wait till next year.
That's extraordinary, Niall.
It is.
The first time that I ever saw a sand martin nesting bank, an artificial one that is, was in Hammersmith in London, actually, in the London Wetland Centre, which is a wonderful spot. Looking forward to going back there whenever travel conditions allow us to do so. But it was a really amazing construction, and it was really well done because actually at the back of it, there's almost a hide you can walk in. There's a door on it, and some of those sand martin tunnels actually have little glass windows at the back, and you can go inside and actually look inside the nest through these little wooden hatches. There's a light in there that the birds can't really notice. It doesn't affect them, and so it was actually amazing to see that nest chamber at the end right up against the glass, to watch the eggs there, see some of the nestlings. It was really mind-blowing. It would be lovely to see something like that in Ireland at some stage, but it really brought home to me just what great natural excavators and engineers these birds are, because it was quite impressive construction. They had dug quite a long way into the cliff face to make these nests. You'd hardly think that such a small bird was capable of doing such a thing, but they are, and it was very impressive.
That's part of your plan for Harper's Island, as I understand it, Jim.
Yes, Derek, you've come down to Harper's Island before, so our listeners should be familiar with it. It's a lovely wetland nature reserve in Cork Harbour, and we've been doing an awful lot of work to create extra habitat for particularly the wetland birds. But one thing is, as I mentioned, we've a lot of sand martins in East Cork, and we are hoping to put in one such artificial sand martin nest bank. And it would be amazing. And why not dream big when you're dreaming, that maybe someday, Niall, you'll be able to come down to Harper's Island and go and look at the nest chambers here at the back of our artificial sand martin breeding cliff. And that is what we plan to do. It is in our conservation plan for the island, and it is definitely something we're hoping to do in the short to medium term.
I'd very much look forward to that, Jim. It's a lovely bird. I think a bird that deserves to be better known by people across Ireland, because they're a really charming species, very cute if you want to look at it in those terms, but also really impressive, the long distances that they travel, the unique kind of habitat that they live in. And as we were talking about Spring Alive earlier, this is another species that we're recording in Birdwatch Ireland through the Spring Alive project. So if you see any sand martins, go to springalive.net and log them there for us, please.
I'm just thinking, guys, when COVID is gone and we can move around freely again, and please God, it'll be sooner than later. If you have an attraction like that, Jim, in Harper's Island, just in Cork, that is going to bring people in by the busload. I mean, if you could get in and see birds nesting, and yet you're not disturbing them, and you're in comfortable surroundings like you have with those two big hides there, that is going to be a major tourist attraction.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be quite an interesting balancing act, because since COVID and people being restricted in their movements, a lot of people have discovered Harper's Island that may not have done so. They might have driven past it before. And it's become hugely popular, and so much so that the Cork County Council, who own Harper's Island, are planning to improve the entrance area, parking area, because of the success. And yes, having somewhere like Harper's Island right in the centre of a huge catchment of people, large population, and showing them their nature, their natural heritage, the wildlife that's on their doorstep up close and personal, I think it makes people value their environment more, their natural environment in particular. And what a spectacle for especially a kid, very impressionable, to bring them in and show them all these wild birds. You know, it's not a zoo, they come and go as they please. And to be able to watch them close up. But definitely, if we manage to get a sand martin bank like that, you know, up and running, and be able to bring people in and show the nest from the back, that would be amazing. So, like, we're always looking for sponsorship and things like that. You know, these things don't run on fresh air, but it's a project we think will definitely be a runner in the next few years.
Jim, I'm just thinking, we keep saying Harper's Island. I know where it is, you know where it is, and the locals might know where it is, but actually you don't have to catch a ferry to go onto the island or anything like that. So will you just describe the lie of the land on the off chance that people within their 5k could perhaps walk down there at the moment, and what might they see?
Yeah, absolutely. Harper's Island is situated at the northern shore of Cork Harbour, very close to Glaunthaun Village and Glaunthaun Railway Station. The N25 is to the south of it, And if you come off the N25 at Carrigtwohill, you can then take what we call the old Cork Road. But if you go to the Birdwatch Cork website, you will find directions and everything you need to know about Harper's Island. What you'll see when you're there, at the moment, I must say that the hides, the viewing hides, are closed because of COVID. We can't afford to have lots of people in an enclosed area mm-hmm. at the moment. But as long as the encouraging signs of society opening up, we will tell people when the hides are open. But even without that, there's a beautiful nature trail on the nature reserve. And in fact, we won an award. We won the Lord Mayor's top award for a community awards just last week for the work we've done down there, because it's been a hugely cooperative endeavour between Cork County Council, Birdwatch Ireland and Glentown community. You can see lots of birds along the nature trail, lots of insects, lots of butterflies now coming out, and it's just off-road. We don't allow dogs or cyclists. There are plenty of places for people to walk dogs and cycle. In fact, there's a whole greenway being established just at the entrance to the wetland. But it's a place for people just to walk in nice and peace and quiet and take in the natural history that they find along the nature trail. I would recommend it. It definitely worth the go. Perfect for the family. Well worth a visit. And we're just in the process of producing some educational activity books, which we hope later on in the year, early next year, we'll publish. We'll definitely have them online, so that if you're a class or if you're a family, you can go down and the kids can engage in some lovely educational activities and have a bit of fun while they're in there.
Yeah, well, I wish you the very best of luck and congratulations, because I know it's a passion of yours. It really is. Just before you guys go, I met this gentleman by the name of Tig earlier today, and he bought me a coffee, so I've got to do something in return. Nothing for nothing. He was telling me that we've got him hooked on birds and that he had a family of robins already in his back garden. I said, are you sure? He said, yeah. And he said, it looked like the adults were feeding the young. Is that possible, guys? It's not just that little bit early.
Derek, in Birdwatch Ireland, we got a record of robins with chicks at the end of January. So that was remarkably early. So a brood at the moment still is early, but I'm sure there are a few of them around the country. Robins will take the opportunity to nest when they can. They want to produce as many young as they can. So if they can get an early start, if conditions are right, and if there's enough food, they'll go for it. So I wish Tig and his robins the very best of luck. I hope they make it.
And we've been getting a number of queries to our Birdwatch Cork Facebook page, asking about the people who have found nests in the last few days have been blackbirds building nests or sitting on nests, and the people from the house who are now going out into the garden a bit more have noticed them. And the questions we get are, what do we do? Do we put a tape around it, or do we change things, or, you know, do we all stay indoors or whatever? And what we usually tell people is just keep doing what you're doing. Don't disturb them. Please don't take, you know, Don't be going in and sticking your nose in them. Just give them space. Let them at it. And there's a very good chance they'll rear their young and successfully. So I wouldn't change much at all, because they obviously liked what was there. They liked the garden. They liked the situation. They didn't see any dangers there. If you've got an animal like a cat or a dog, well, obviously there's going to be problems there, and I would advise during the breeding season that you keep a tight rein on dogs and cats too, by the way, because they will spot these nests, especially early nesters. There's not as much foliage in the hedges or on the trees, and the nests can be a bit exposed. Sometimes they feel that these are young birds trying out for the first time. So they can be a bit more vulnerable to predation, especially by cats. And I'd watch that. But other than that, just leave it as it is. Don't touch anything. Let them at it and they should be fine.
Jim, thank you very much indeed. And we'll be talking to you in the next couple of weeks again in the lead up to the Dawn Chorus, which is taking place this year on Sunday, the 2nd of May. That's the first Sunday, which is indeed the peak time to hear the birds sing. So Jim Wilson of Cove, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Derek.
And thanks to you too, Niall Hatch in Shankill, on site there watching the sand martins as they prepare to nest for another season. Thanks also to Aina Nilana, to Richard Collins, and broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, and researcher John Bell O'Reilly.
We want you to be part of the Moonigoes Wild Citizen Science Army. So send in those records of your first cuckoo if you hear it or if you manage to get a snap of it. rte.ie/Mooney for all the details. Until next week, goodbye. Mooney Goes Wild needs you.
The interesting thing about the cuckoo's song, Derek, is that the cook part of the song is made with the mouth open, while the oo part of it is made with the mouth closed.
Join the Mooney Goes Wild army of citizen scientists by sending your records of the first cuckoo to mooney@rte.ie.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.